Welcome to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates, where we believe that advocacy is the answer. Hey, everybody, it's Angela, and today I am here with Deborah and with John, and we are going to talk about a topic that impacts likely all of you, and that is when you represent a dependent child who is also involved in delinquency proceedings. We know from experience in our consulting that this is handled very differently throughout the country, whether it's state by state or county by county. There's a wide range of practices. And so we just wanted to talk about some of the strategies that you might be able to use in your own county. And we'll start off with Deborah, just a little bit of the national picture.
Thanks, Angela. When we decided to talk about this topic, again, like we talked about in the last podcast, it was something that seems like it's been coming up for decades. This notion called crossover kids, now sometimes dual system, dually involved, dual status is the way we're going to try and talk about it here on the podcast. For years now, we've known that there are special needs that these kids have that requires an approach that's more coordinated so that things don't take longer, fall through the cracks, that the representation is what these kids deserve. The problems that these kids are facing, the dual status kids, include things like higher risk for mental health, poor placement stability, worse permanency outcomes, longer stays in detention, higher rates of recidivism. And so I just did a quick Google search to sort of see what the status was across the country and what kind of progress had been made. And one of the things I found said, despite progress, most jurisdictions were reporting that these dual status youth continued to face problems with fragmented services, increased placement instability, and disproportionate impacts on minority youth. According to Casey Family Programs, one of the statistics that was most impactful to me was that 92% of the crossover youth are first involved in the child welfare system. That's a pretty stark statistic, and just a reminder of how important it is to match the right services with the right needs so that people are not re-entering the system through a different door. Angela?
Yeah, as you were talking, I was thinking about one of the things that I experienced was, which was kids coming in the other way, where the judges were looking at the charges and trying to access the resources of the child welfare system. But the statistic is helpful because it does clarify that it's largely coming the other way. John, I think it would be helpful to talk a little bit about how your office handles things, because I know it is unique.
Yeah, sure. And I'm so glad. Thank you, Deborah, for doing the national picture on that, because I tried to do some looking myself, because just anecdotally, it feels like this population is surging right now. Our judges say things to us about it. And it also feels like it's becoming more complex and difficult to serve. I think even the chief of our local Department of Juvenile Justice made a comment like that they're really more of a mental health agency now than a juvenile justice agency because of the complexity of the kids that they are seeing. So, and I don't think, like, when I look nationally, I couldn't see that surge yet because the national data is that I could find was like in 2022. But I feel like when they get to 2024 and 2025, you're going to see this spike in older youth entering foster care and then crossing over and become dually involved. So what we have in our office, and it was more by accident than by design, was the very first children we served were the older youth. And that's because, and if you're practicing in a jurisdiction where the law allows the court to simply appoint you when the court wants to appoint you, right, as opposed to perhaps being appointed to every child, right, then I think you're probably going to experience what we experienced, is when it's up to the judge does what you would expect, appoint you to the most difficult, complex cases where the judge, she or he, is looking at it going, I need someone to help this kid. This kid has fallen in a crack. I need someone to get this kid out of the crack. You end up developing this expertise on dealing with these complex, dually involved youth. And then in our consulting, the fascinating thing we learned when we saw an office try to start up with serving the entire population is that these dually involved youth, right, they pull you into their world, into their cases, and they pull you away from the general, if you will, population of foster kids who are moving through foster care and need to get to permanence quickly. It's almost like two specialties. This is a very specialized practice area of serving older youth, and many of them are dually involved. So what is it that you can do to make yourself effective in this area, and why is it important? I'll start with the why first, I think. I think the why is because when you walk into the delinquency court, you see your state attorney, you see your public defender, you see your client, and you see the bailiff, and you see probably the guards from the detention center. And even though it's not criminal, it might as well be criminal. In my jurisdiction, at least, those public defenders, they rotate. They were just in felony, right? Or misdemeanors. And the state attorneys, they rotate, right? These are criminal defense attorneys and criminal prosecutors.
But or in training to do that. Like they start out in representing youth, training for the quote unquote big cases, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Right. All of those other cases that they work on are the state versus the defendant. And they walk into delinquency court, at least in my state, and it's still in the interest of the child, because it is, the focus is not on punishment. It is on rehabilitation. So I think that's one place where the child's attorney can make a big impact, right? Is by bringing the focus back to rehabilitation. Now, how do you do that? You have to, one thing you can do is you can change the narrative in the courtroom, right? Is you can control the narrative somewhat. Because when you walk in, I can't tell you how many cases I've walked in, that you want almost all of them. The narrative is, you've done something wrong. You're the defendant. You're sitting in the defendant's chair. Your public defender is next to you. You're accused of basically a delinquent act, but they might as well be calling it a crime. In the kid's mind, they think it's a crime they've committed. You know, they were arrested by the police. They were taken away in a car, a police car. They were put in basically a jail for juveniles. And now they're in front of a scary judge and in their mind, and they're like, I've committed a crime. So it's a delinquent act. And the question now is, why is the child before the delinquency court, right? So what can I do to change the narrative here? One way to do that is you're the child's attorney. In a dependency case, you have access to those records, right? I can't tell you how many times I've been sitting in a delinquency court and the parent is the victim of a domestic battery of some type or another. Sometimes it's very serious. And sometimes it's still a delinquent act. It's still a battery, but it's because somebody threw a cell phone and accidentally hit someone with it. Or it's a push. It's a shove. It's a shoving match. And the child got charged. But doesn't matter. The question is, the child is before the delinquency court because of family violence. Okay? So if you can pull up, if you know the history of that family violence, and you can educate not just the public defender, but the state attorney and the judge. Let's talk about why we're here so we don't keep coming back. Oh, that my client was allegedly violent towards their mother, but from the ages of 3 through 6, my client was in foster care because of witnessing domestic violence between the mother and her partner at the time. So my client has perhaps been programmed that when you get angry, you lash out with violence. That's what they were taught to do as a child, and now they're doing it, and we're shocked. We can see the narrative here, and we can connect the dots to help the family and help the child and help the court. Because, again, back to the public defender, state attorney, criminal analogy here is there's only two options in criminal court, really, right? It's probation or incarceration. It's probation, yeah. Or for us, commitment to a commitment program, a juvenile commitment program of some kind, or some kind of whatever they call it in your state, residential commitment program, juvenile justice program. And what we can do now, armed with the knowledge of the family's background, is provide alternatives that may be more meaningful in terms of rehabilitation as opposed to punishment. And it takes some time to get juvenile justice on board and to get the state attorney on board. But if you embrace them as team members, right? I like to sit in between the two, and I will whisper in the public defender's ear, and then I will whisper in the state attorney's ear. Maybe the same thing, but they both think I'm telling secrets. I'm sharing information.
So can I just jump in here, John, because you acknowledge that in your jurisdiction, you have a well-established program with the expectation from the judges that this is the role that you'll play. And when I did the national research, I saw a lot of really innovative programs around the country and some amazing coordination. But my guess is not only do we have listeners who are not working as part of a child's law office or with legal aid, they're either on their own or they're listening to this and chuckling to themselves like, my judge isn't going to do that. Those people at DJJ, you know, juvenile justice are not going to return my call. And so if you don't have the structure already in place, what kind of small overtures could be made to benefit the kids that you are appointed to represent straight up dependency court?
Right. So we built it from the ground up with no idea where we were going, right? But what became apparent is that we were getting appointed by judges who had a problem on their hands and they basically wanted solutions, right? We call it almost like service advocacy because we do not replace the public defender. We come alongside the other two attorneys in the courtroom to address the underlying problem of why this child is coming before the delinquency court, sometimes repeatedly, right? Like I said, we became experts because we had to. And one way you can do this is to arm yourself with knowledge, because knowledge in this area is such power. Like I said, the menu of options for a judge is probation, commitment, but maybe you can come forward with other options. If you look at a family's history, if you look at the child's history and you're like, okay, my client obviously is leaning on substances too heavily, is using substances too heavily, even if it's marijuana, is just excessively using it. It's interfering with school. It's interfering with the relationship with their mother, et cetera, et cetera. It's causing them to steal from Walmart or whatever. So then you can start to suggest remedies to the court, like, judge, why don't we defer to the state attorney. Let's defer prosecution and see if they can complete this substance abuse program. And the kid might not want to go to a substance abuse program. See, that's one thing of the child's attorney is, gee, I can't just tell my client, I think you need inpatient treatment. How many kids are going to go, okay, sure, sign me up. Where do I go? None of them, right? But you can lay out the cards that they have been dealt. And I do think that's our job, is to talk honestly with them ahead of time. I'm not manipulating the facts. I'm revealing the facts to the child, is that I can tell you right now that with your public defender consulting you, you're facing these options. This is the hand you've been dealt. Here's a card. It helps you with what is a problem for you, excessive use of marijuana. It gets your criminal case deferred and possibly you don't have a record and this case goes away. And it looks like you're going to be going somewhere anyway, you know, and to a commitment program that could be much longer than this 6-week substance abuse program. So the kids then come around to like, oh, yeah, this is less punitive, more rehabilitative. I don't have to leave town to go to some commitment program somewhere. And the way we did this is we would actually take field trips. This is how you arm yourself with the knowledge. You actually take field trips. It's not easy. You got to pencil out the day and you got to do it. You can't do it right away, but you go around and you visit these places. And if they know you're coming, a lot of them like to have visitors, and they'll have all their printed materials out to give you. They'll take you on a tour. They'll introduce you to some kids who are in there and you'll learn a lot. But what you're really doing there is building relationships that you can call upon when you need these placements, when you need a service for your client. And I can guarantee you almost every place you visit, you will eventually need for some client down the road. And so it's a worthwhile investment of your time to build these relationships with people just by taking a field trip. And then you're sitting in delinquency court, and after a while you're sitting there listening to cases that aren't even yours, and you're thinking, wow, I'm not on this case, but I can't believe nobody knows where this kid should be right now. I know where this kid, what this kid needs right now. And you might go whisper it in the public defender's ear or the state attorney's ear. So knowledge is power. That's how you start to build. That's how you start to build an expertise in this area.
One of the things that I have remembered in talking with people in different states is that in some areas, when both systems are involved, they are each trying to get rid of the kid. So the delinquency side, juvenile justice is, ooh, this is great. Let's kick this over to child welfare so they'll pay. And child welfare is like, well, that's placement. Now we don't need to be engaged anymore. Is that something you experience where you are? And if so, what is it that a child's lawyer can do in those circumstances?
Yeah, that's tough. I know what you mean. Those kids, and those are the, I guess we can call them the expensive dual status kids,
yeah,
right? The ones with the deeper end mental health problems. They've burned through all of the dependency systems placements, and they're just hoping that DJJ will commit them. And DJJ knows the score, like you said. They're like, this is a mental health kid. This isn't really a delinquent kid. We're not going to violate their probation. At that point, I have had those cases where, yeah, you do have that standoff. And I think this is where the child's attorney can be the connective tissue, not just in court between the state and the public defender, but between the agencies. And you can, and I don't know if they have them there, but not every county or city has the same multidisciplinary cooperation that gets built in other areas, but this is how it starts, right? Is somebody saying, we all need to meet. Even if we don't have a name for this meeting, it doesn't mean we can't meet, right? Like, I want to get the chief of the juvenile justice together with the program administrator for child and families and children and families and get you guys all in the room together to talk about this complex kid and just shine a spotlight on your client, as in, hey guys, you know, no one at the table will say, oh, we're just trying to play hot potato with this child. No,
right.
You get them all together. In those meetings, actually, I have had to do very little once I got everyone at the table, because then there's ownership and no one in a public meeting is going to say, well, we can't do this. Instead of saying we can't, people will maybe start to say, we can do this. What about this? And they start to solve problems when you bring them together. That's been my experience. Those kids are expensive, though, and sometimes it requires litigation. It requires litigation to get the money, which is there between two large state agencies, even in the poorer states. Money, I was told, when I represented the state once, this is a good story. I represented the state, and I had this very good private attorney coming at my client because they wanted this kid in this $400 a day program, which at the time was probably more like an $800 a day program with inflation, okay? And my walking orders were, we do not have that kind of money. We do not spend that kind of money. It's a no, 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 no. Well, this attorney knew someone. She got people together in a room and they got the money. She put some media pressure on them. She could put some political pressure on them. She got the money. And she's a very experienced attorney. And she pulled me aside. I was a very young attorney afterwards. She said, John, the money is there. They'll tell you, your client will tell you they don't have the money. The money is there. Yeah. If the will is there, you have to find the right person who says, yes, we have the will to spend it on this child. So, you know, I mean, they can send kids out of state when they want to and pay. So it's a dance, right? It's a dance. It's political. It's litigation. It's, yeah.
Well, to Deborah's earlier question, like if there is no coordination where you are, step one could just be that meeting. That way, if that's not happening, getting everybody in the same room on a case where there isn't an obvious placement, an obvious service, that might be step one.
Yeah. Know your community, I think, is another way to say it. Know the places in the community and know the people that are pulling the levers. And before we leave that point, you know, I suspect that there are people listening who are not in the middle of a coordinated effort, and you're thinking to yourself, I have X number of cases. How could I possibly take this on that just I'm going to develop this other specialty? It's difficult to find the time. Sometimes you don't have that kind of time and you just have to solve the problem that lands in your lap. So if you can do a little bit of the upfront work, even if in your jurisdiction people aren't excited about having a unified court system or the level of integration that is present where John practices, there still are some ways that people can make positive progress in this area without having to drop everything and become a delinquency expert.
And I would add to that that there are a lot of folks out there practicing on a wheel or as a contract attorney. So you're not in an office where you can divide and conquer, but there's nothing preventing you from coordinating with other child attorneys and trying to divide and conquer and say, let's all go, let's work together on this, go out, see these places, come back, share the information. I mean, there are ways to coordinate because you're in court all the time, and acknowledging that it's better to do that at a time when you don't have a child in detention whose parent won't pick them up. Like, that happens. That happens more than anyone would like to believe. It's much harder to squeeze it in then than to try and make a plan to kind of really know the community, like you said, Deborah.
There are so many important roles for the child's attorney to play, like the child that is sitting in the detention center because the case manager wasn't alerted, or they don't have a bed, so they're letting them sit in the detention center illegally, or the child who's waiting for a commitment program and is in foster care and is being left in the detention center instead of in the community because it's easier. And those are big issues. The global issue is that the population we serve, kids in foster care, are drastically overrepresented in the prison population, the adult prison population, right? There's just statistically way too many people in prison who touched foster care when they were younger. This is a point where the child's attorney, and I know it sounds trite to say that, oh, you can go into court and change the narrative or go on a field trip and change a kid's life and keep them out of prison, but you literally can. It's not just you, but it's the phone call you make to get the bed that avoids the kid going to a commitment program and instead getting the help they need, or changing a judge's perspective on a child when they find out, oh, they were the subject of 14 abuse reports when they were growing up. Maybe the state attorney thinks a little differently. Maybe the Department of Juvenile Justice starts to think a little I can tell you that works.
Can I jump in there, John? When you all started your program, did you have to overcome any barriers to getting that kind of access to the court? Like, a lot of states are, that dependency information is on lockdown, and sharing it from one proceeding to another often requires statutory change. Perhaps your orders of appointment are broader in that way.
Excellent point. Yeah.
Talk to us a little bit about that, because I was just thinking to myself, man, if this is the first time I was doing this, I would really want to make sure I understood where the avenues were for me to present information permissibly.
Right. And in many places, the state attorneys can have access to this information on a limited basis. And I don't do that without my client's consent. And the public defenders, of course, are also their attorneys, so they can consent to the public defender getting this information. And we have the same, in my jurisdiction, the same judge. So the same judge already knows this about a child and recognizes the child from their dependency docket. So that makes it easier. But a good point, Deborah. It all depends upon where you practice and what the rules are on confidentiality, and then getting informed consent from your client. If you're going to reveal their information, it's their information. And now, in some areas, I guess it could be parent consent. But I think if the child is like, yeah, if this is going to help me get out of this criminal case, let's tell the judge that I was in foster care. But I always do. That's sensitive information, too. It's personal information. So I always make sure the client knows before I share it that this is my strategy. But when it comes to sentencing and disposition, what if we broaden the picture for the court and the state attorney and the public defender and show them that singular instance of family violence on a timeline so they understand your actions a little better? It gives a little more context to your actions, right? It's like when you watch the NFL replay and you see the penalty flag fly, and then they roll back the tape and they go, look what happened before he shoved that guy. And you're like, oh, now I know why he shoved him. It's like that. So it's sort of that's a bad analogy, but it's what you see.
Well, I don't know.
When you zoom out and you look at the whole family dynamic, you can start to understand what looks like unreasonable behavior on some of our duly involved youth, at least gives it some context for everybody in the courtroom, and then the judge can make more informed decisions. Because ultimately it is about rehabilitation, because they do want to prevent the step up to the adult prison system.
Well, I think this is a good place to wrap up our discussion on this topic. There's obviously a lot of nuance in representing kids involved in both types of proceedings. And we do recognize that some of you may be starting from scratch in terms of coordinating. So just remember that you can always take one of the steps that we outlined today, whether it's bringing the experience and the knowledge of your client, scheduling a meeting, just showing up for them. Any of that is a step in the right direction. So we want to thank you all so much for listening. And if you haven't yet, please take a moment to subscribe. Thanks, everyone.
You've been listening to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates. Please take a moment to subscribe and spread the word. Thank you.